ironically on the feast of Saint Benedict.
She must have planned it that way.
Well, yes.
In fact,
she's going to go out, you go out in style.
The day
right?
of her funeral, we had a horrendous snowstorm.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. We're so glad you tuned in.
First, a boomer's two-year journey seeking spiritual renewal, and he didn't have to travel to an ashram in India to find fulfillment.
Then meet a lawyer with a winning record coaching beauty pageant contestants to success on the runway.
Next, do you have inker's remorse? The booming business of tattoo removal.
Plus the enduring legacy of one determined nun.
And we'll shoot the breeze about spiritual retreats.
Lee Kravitz was in his 50s with a wife and three kids, living the life in New York City. Then came 9/11, the day that forever changed the world. Unsatisfied with the lack of a significant spiritual component in his life, Lee did what many boomers do. He began a religious quest.
Lee Kravitz is the former editor-in-chief of Parade magazine. He chronicles his unlikely pilgrimage in his new book, aptly titled Pilgrim, Risking the Life I Have to Find the Faith I Seek. Lee joins us on the phone from New York. Great to have you with us, Lee.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lee, what started you on this spiritual quest?
Well, there were a couple things. One was 9/11, when although I had very young kids at the time, and 9/11 raised a lot of questions I couldn't answer, and I couldn't comfort them from my heart. When my son, who was 5 years old, was sitting in the room I'm sitting in now, and I came home and he has his eyes closed, he was pretending he was dying and he thought he was going to be killed. And he asked me, Dad, what comfort can you give me? I also had a health scare. One day I had what I felt was a heart attack, and I found myself calling out for God. And I had found myself increasingly aching and yearning for God. I didn't know if I could define God, but I did feel a deep, deep ache for something more in my life, like many boomers feel.
Lee, did you grow up with a particular religion?
I grew up with Judaism. And when I was young, I went to a conservative Jewish synagogue in Cleveland, Ohio. And the services were very dry and very unspiritual to me. You know, I had to get dressed up, and people seemed more concerned with what they wore in a fashion sense than for any exploration of the inner life. And so that's what I grew up with.
Did you have a bar mitzvah?
I had a bar mitzvah, and I did pretty well at it. My voice didn't change in the middle of it. I felt that I was doing it more for my parents than myself at the time.
Did you feel like it was more of a cultural thing in your life rather than a religious part of your life?
Well, I thought it was both, but I even then had a feeling that there was something deeper that I wanted to experience that I wasn't experiencing, that it wasn't addressing my adolescent need at the time for a deeper meaning or to explore what the purpose of my life would have been. I wasn't finding that in the religion of my birth.
Now, Lee, you mentioned your little boy and kind of his maybe own, in some sort of way, quest to kind of be comforted or find some answers. But did your wife and your other children, did they have that same spiritual need that you had?
No, the big part of my personal spiritual quest is that I was yearning deeply for God, and yet my wife is an atheist, and my children have the inclinations of being atheists. So why I'm feeling a need to go out and find a spiritual home where I can embrace or explore that yearning, my wife didn't understand it. You know, she didn't get the God stuff, and she couldn't understand why I couldn't find that level of happiness and fulfillment in the wonderful family life we had made together.
How did she really feel about your pursuit then?
Well, she's a very supportive, wonderful person. But, you know, when you go on a deep spiritual pursuit like I did, sometimes there is that risk that you'll pull away from the other people in your life. It's very compelling. And so I think there is a little bit of a fear there. And also that feeling that, well, what have my wife feeling? Well, what am I not giving in the home we're living in? what am I not giving as a wife and in terms of our family that would make my husband feel more fulfilled?
Well, you know, it seems like lots of people, especially, you know, as we get older, we do look for more spiritual longing. And it seems like we're more aware of our mortality. You know, we're looking for answers, like you said, to 9/11 or if somebody dies or when bad things really happen. So the subtitle of your book, which I thought was really interesting, Risking the Life I Have to Find the Faith I Seek. So why did you feel like you were risking it all in your quest for a spiritual home? Is it because of your family's feelings about your quest?
Yes, it was because there was the real possibility. Look, I made a decision not to go to India to an ashram or Greece to a monastery or go far away. I was going to conduct my quest near my family and home. And yet, even though I had made that commitment to them and to the life that I was living, there was that possibility that I would become so involved in my inner quest that I would pull away or separate from the people I loved. So that was a real risk. It's the risk of going deeper. Now, in the end, even though there was tension throughout my quest, that didn't happen. I, in fact, found at the end of my quest that I had only more love to give, that I found a way that my spirituality could coexist with my family. And you raise a great point about boomers. I think this is a very common feeling among boomers. We've lived our lives. To some extent, we've had children. We've had jobs. We've achieved a great deal. And we ask ourselves the question, what more is there as we age? And that is a spur to finding a community of people or a spiritual home that allows you to explore that.
We're here talking with Lee Kravitz about his 2-year journey seeking spiritual renewal. He's the former editor-in-chief of Parade magazine, and his book is called Pilgrim, Risking the Life I Have to Find the Faith I Seek. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour. I'm Barbara Klein, along with my co-host, Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or when you visit iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Lee Kravitz.
Lee, how did you go about narrowing down the religious options for your quest?
The first thing I did was, on the internet, I found myself trying a quiz called BeliefNet, which matched people's religious beliefs to particular religions. And it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But as I was doing it, I saw that I had an inclination to certain contemplative religions, Quakerism, Mahayana Buddhism, you know, a variety of religions I'd never considered deeply in my life. So that was one thing. I decided I would try something new. Secondly, a lot of it happened just by happenstance. My neighbor from upstairs in my apartment building came down one day and said, I hear you're interested in Quakerism, and she invited me to a Quaker meeting. And for almost 2 years, I went to Quaker meetings, which are just a phenomenal, phenomenal experience if you've never gone to them, where you sit in silence for an hour trying to listen to the voice within among other people who are doing that. And it was such a different experience than anything I'd had before and really opened me up to looking inside and listening to other people who are also searching for spiritual depth.
Do you think your Quaker moments kind of helped you wrap your arms around what was going on maybe within your thoughts?
Absolutely. There's nothing like, especially when you live in New York City or Chicago or a big city, which is so hectic, where there's so many distractions in your mind outside, to have that sort of silence which enables you to calm down, center yourself, go within is a phenomenal experience. And it opens you up. It opens up your heart. It opens up your imagination. It's really quite a wonderful thing. And then from the Quakerism, I moved on to various sorts of meditation, Buddhist meditation, which took me in another and deeper direction. And everything's one thing seemed to lead to another. For a while, I was doing the art of Hindu devotional chanting, which is repeating the names of God, chanting the names of God and call and response, one of the most famous practitioners of that is a man named Krishnadas, who, if you take yoga classes, you've probably heard his music in the background. And that was spectacular in terms of opening me up to ecstatic prayer, a way that I could, having been in silence, now be able to join with other people in that sort of wonderful gospel-like rhythmic prayer, which can be so inspiring and motivating. So one thing kept leading to another.
And then, Lee, you also tried out Hasidic Judaism, we understand?
A neo-Hasidic form of Judaism. I had grown up in a very assimilated Judaism where there was not real excitement or movement during times of prayer, where you sat in your seat, where there was a lot of rules. And the form of Judaism that I found myself coming to was one where it incorporated a lot of the Eastern practices I had done. It had contemplative meditation, it had chanting, it had movement in terms of people, when they felt compelled to do it, could dance. It was very deep, and it was very grounded in the study of Torah, the Holy Scripture of Judaism. So all of a sudden, I found myself returning to a Judaism that I didn't even know existed when I was young, and rediscovering my birthright religion with new eyes, which was a wonderful, wonderful experience. It was almost like I had to go away from the religion of my childhood and go on this long journey in order to come back to something that spoke to me and gave me what I needed in my boomerhood.
And Lee, did you find that these religions that you explored, did they have certain commonalities that you rediscovered?
I think I experienced religion when I was young, and even during that long period of 30 years when I didn't concern myself with spiritual matters, I thought religions were in silos. You know, everyone trying to assert their own religion as the true path. Well, the religions that I was drawn to and eventually all had a very welcoming attitude, a sense that we're all one in this universe, that as the Quakers say, there is that of God within each of us, no matter what our religion is. I saw that feeling that replicated in at the center of each practice that I undertook. And I feel now I can go into into spiritual communities and religious communities, feel welcomed and feel receptive and respect people for what they're there to get out of that particular experience.
And Lee, how has your family responded to your finding your new spiritual home, shall we say?
Well, my teenagers, I wish I could say that they come and join me. They don't. They like to go out with their friends on Friday nights and Saturdays, and that's exactly what they should be doing.
Yeah, give them a few years, right?
Yeah, I'm giving them a few years. It could be 20 years, and they'll have the book to read, and they'll have seen that their dad did this and continues to do it. But they need to be teenagers. They need to experience their lives and find their truths and their path on their own. And my wife, she remains an atheist, but she has begun baking challah.
Ooh.
Every Friday. It's
what wonderful. About blintzes?
Oh, she does that too. But every Friday night challah, we have a Friday night dinner. We do the blessings over the candles, the wine, the challah. And that's become an important part of her life and our life as a family. And she does it not for the deeply religious reasons I do, but there's a spirituality to why she does it, because she wants our children to have these memories of family, caring, and love that they'll take on into their futures and their own families.
Well, it is true that those rituals and those relationships are just lifetime memory builders.
Oh, absolutely.
And Lee, I thought it was just fascinating that you actually consulted a spiritually gifted astrologer. What was that like?
She was really important in the whole process because, first of all, I've been to astrologers in the past, and I have a sort of open-mindedness. I'm not a true believer in that regard. But there are people, and this woman was one of them, who are really instinctively wise and tuned in. And she was the person who eventually, who saw this sort of spiritual need in me, but eventually said, you know, you might think about going back to Judaism. You were incarnated. I'm not sure I believe in reincarnation, but she said you were incarnated in this life as a Jew. You were born into it, and it may have some of the answers you're seeking. But she was sort of saying, go forth back into Judaism. And it was absolutely the right thing to say it to me at the right time.
Lee, do you think there's a difference between being spiritual and being religious?
Yes, I do. I think you can be both rather easily. We tend to think of religious as someone who practices according to one branded religion and who is steeped in the rules of that religion, whereas spirituality, to me, signifies more an effort to get in touch with the spirit of your inner life. And that inner life can be that which connects you to other people in the universe. It doesn't have to be in a particular religion, but it can be that it ends up being enhanced if you do follow certain practices. So there is a difference, but they can also be very compatible and the same.
Well, Lee Kravitz, author of Pilgrim, Risking the Life I Have to Find the Faith I Seek, thanks so much for sharing your spiritual journey with the Two Boomer Babes.
And thank you, Two Boomer Babes.
Bill Alverson is a prominent attorney who has won multi-million dollar cases before the Supreme Court of Alabama and the U.S. Court of Appeals. But that's his day job. On the side, he's also one of the most successful beauty pageant coaches in America, counting Miss USA 2012, Miss America 2013, and the reigning Miss USA among his clients.
So how does being in front of a courtroom translate to the world of beauty pageants? And exactly what winning advice does he give his clients? We'll find out. Bill Alverson is on the phone with us from Andalusia, Alabama. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here, ladies.
Now, we have a new Miss America. Did you have any clients in the running?
Her.
Ooh, really?
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Winner.
Yes, it's unusual. It was a three-peat for the state of New York to have Miss America, but it was also a three-peat for me in that she was also an interview client of mine that I began working with last February.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Exciting.
Thank you so much.
So, Bill, how did you get started in the beauty pageant coaching business?
You know, it's an odd story. I moved to Andalusia in 1990, and it's a small, old southern town. Got active in my church, sang in the choir. I used to have theater background, that kind of stuff. And one day my choir director came up to me and said, hey, there's this sweet, nice girl, and she's in my choir at school. Her parents are older. They don't know what's doing, but she's doing this county junior miss, which would go to the state junior miss, national junior miss, when junior miss was a big pageant. And she said, would you just meet with her, make her feel better? And so I did. Her name was Emily. And we just revamped, started, came up with a talent, choreographed, and lo and behold, she won. And she was not a wallflower girl in high school, but she wasn't the most popular girl. She was just a girl that went to high school and just had a great life. And what happened after that, people started calling me. They were like, what happened? They didn't see this one coming. And then it just kind of grew into that. Then I started judging somewhat. Then I got involved as a local director in the Miss America organization with a co-director of mine for about 3 years. And then I kind of backed off to spend time with my kids. And then what really kicked it was a clothing store was doing a trunk show with one of these pageant gown designers. And he said, look, you've had girls that you've had Miss Alabama's. Would you come in and just do an interview? I want to give more than just buy a dress. I want my shop to expand. And he really had a vision there. So I didn't really know what I was doing, meeting different people from different circumstances, kind of honed in the skills, and then it just kind of grew from that and word of mouth, really. And then I've been to Oklahoma, Ohio, New Jersey, Texas, to different shops and places where people do the same thing, and fortunately I've had some great women to work with.
So who was your first big success in the pageant world?
Scarlett Dupree. She was Miss Alabama 2001, I think, and she was first runner-up at Miss America. I was her local director in the Miss America system, and we just stayed together the whole route. And she would probably be my first one that bursted out on the national scene.
Wow. Now, your day job really is as an attorney.
Correct.
How do you think your courtroom experience helps you in the beauty pageant world?
Well, it really kind of transcends pretty easily, even though it really seems like a paradox to most people. When I'm presenting a client to go in front of a jury, it's just like I'm presenting the girl to go in front of a panel. You've got to make whatever you're selling be relevant to them. And so we do jury profiles. We kind of understand the dynamic as best we can for the demographics of the people that are in front of that jury. Then when I have a witness or I have my client telling their story, we've got to be clear about how we're going to be presenting that, because the jury can't ask questions. I can. And then there's cross-examination. And are we going to be consistent with what we're presenting so people gather it? The same way I'm arguing a motion in front of the judge. I want the judge to understand this is the merits of the case, this is what's going on, but also put it in a way that's digestible and that we can understand. Just like with your listeners, you understand subject matters that they want to listen to and what you bring to the table, but you've got to make it germane. And that's kind of where it kind of builds up, starting with these young ladies and other people that I work with interviews, because I do that outside of pageants as well, to where they get the essence of who you are. And then if they get the essence of who you are, then you've got a connection that you can build upon.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes, and we're talking with Bill Alverson. By day, he's an attorney. On the side, he has a very successful side gig as a beauty pageant coach.
So, Bill, you specialize in preparing the contestants for the interview segments, right?
Correct.
So how do you prepare them for that?
Well, the first thing is we've got to find out if they know themselves. And believe it or not, as easy as that sounds, that's the biggest hurdle, particularly with teenagers and even college girls, because they say what they think I want to hear or what their parents are, who they should be or want them to be, instead of who they truly are. And once we can kind of break through that veneer of getting some truthfulness there, then we start to see where your strengths are, where your deficiencies are. If you don't know anything about current events, why do you not retain information from reading well? So let's look at video. Or do you even understand what a community service is? Are you helping other people? So it's a development process. Many people refer to it as a life coach, because hopefully these skills go beyond the set pageant you're going to try to win or want to be. And that's kind of where it kind of starts.
Well, how do you get to the bottom of who they are? I mean, is it like a probing question kind of process?
Certainly. It's an open dialogue. Many times I get their resume or information sheet, so I start asking them questions. And then I find out what mama or daddy put on the form versus what they put on the form. And then we don't even get into controversial issues initially. I want to know, you know, why you're a cheerleader, why you love sports, why you are dancing, what are your activities, what do you like to do for fun? You kind of have to do a little therapeutic psychoanalysis of understanding who and what and where they're from. And then we build upon that, and it just sort of opens up. Many times I have them look at me going, oh, my God, you're telling me things about you. But a lot of that's like jury analysis. You know, you can tell a lot from people by what they choose to do with their free time.
Well, Bill, what is it that you do that's different that other coaches do? I mean, you clearly have a lot of winning contestants. What is it that you do that's different?
I don't really know exactly what other coaches do, except that I've seen the results and activities of what some of these other coaches do. Many of these other coaches love pageants, and they're wrapped up in the whole pageant world. Some of them, I think, if they were females, would have been contestants. That wouldn't have been me. So I approach it academically, and I approach it differently, and I think the legal experience that I have, the ability to cross-examine, the ability to determine if that's genuine or fake, it's that ability is what I have individually that a lot of people don't have. And then I will also, I'm very direct. I will tell them really quick, that's a load of crap. Don't waste my time or your time. Why are you saying that? What are you doing? I worked with last year's Miss America, for example, and reviewed her state-winning interview. And at one thing, I stopped the tape and went, you didn't know what you're talking about. And other people that were helping on the prep team, you know, like, oh, that's a good answer. That could work. And then she looked and she goes, no, he completely exposed me. That I was having to fudge. And I'm like, let's eliminate that out of the interview. Let's make all your answers as genuine as we can to the plan that you want to have to market. So I think that's a little bit different. I'm not a cheerleader. I'm not going to say, hey, you're fantastic and wonderful. Go win Miss Fruit Festival. I think that's disingenuous, and I'm not going to play pageant. But another thing is I don't get emotionally involved, and a lot of people do, and then that blinds your critique analysis, I think.
And Bill, how much do you charge for your services?
I'm $125 an hour. It's less than my hourly legal rate, but this is not legal advice. And so that's why it's at a lower rate, even though I will work with people during my work hours.
Bill, how important is it to sort of manage the expectations of your clients? I mean, do you ever get a girl that you just think can't make it and you just have to tell them that?
I think that's a very good question, and very few people actually ask me that. I do manage the expectations. I worked with a girl one time, for example, who had won her junior miss program, was second runner-up at state, which was really well, but when she was competing in this college program, she had gained a lot of weight. She's still talented and vivacious. And when she was trying on gowns and I was talking with her mom, I just said, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm going to talk to Sarah about being in the top five, not winning the program. And I don't say you're not going to win. It becomes our goal is top five. I want the girls to feel successful. If they're going to a state for the first time and it's one of these, like a Miss America, where you usually go over and over and over again, it might be our goal is top 10. Our goal is a preliminary win. And anything else beyond that is going to be gravy, and we're going to work to win, but a realistic goal. And typically, because I'm very honest, that almost gives it more teeth, because we can all think we're going to be queen of the world, but realistically, can we be there? So there is some realistic expectations. And then once we've done the work, the week before, it's a different type of preparation I do. We evaluate where we were and where we are. So they see the success of the work that they've done, and then when you feel successful, you're always more engaging.
Well, Bill Alverson, beauty pageant coach and lawyer, thank you so much for sharing your story with the Two Boomer Babes and giving us a little inside scoop into the pageant world.
Glad to do it.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, a boomer's beautiful side gig. Stay with us. This statistic surprised even us babes. According to a recent Harris poll, about 20% of adults between the ages of 40 and 64 have one or more tattoos. For those younger than 40, that number at least doubles.
But what if one has inker's remorse? Say that certain someone's name, branded across your arm, is now in the arms of another, or that rose on your backside doesn't look so sweet or so small anymore. Well, Ken Saylor has built a thriving business around tattoo regret. He's the owner of Advanced Laser Tattoo Removal here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ken, you have a steady stream of clients looking to get rid of their tattoos. After going through all that pain, which I cannot even imagine, and expense to get your tattoo, what are some of the reasons people really want them removed?
It's not always about regret. As it turns out, they've done studies, and 40% of the people that come in for tattoo removal is job-related. You'd like to think that your employer is a little bit more liberal, but there's lots of studies that say if you have a tattoo, you will have a harder time getting a job, particularly if there's client contact.
Ken, tell us about your very diverse clientele. I mean, they're really from every walk of life, right?
My clientele is everybody in the spectrum, from embassy people, professional white-collar, blue-collar, criminals, everybody you could think of has a reason to take a tattoo off. I have a lot of military. The military has been cracking down on visible tattoos, and even people that have been there for a while, officers want it now below their short sleeve shirts. Usually it was on the wrists or anything exposed when there was a long sleeve shirt or the neck or face, anything that would expose. And for some people that are in a little bit more sensitive positions, like CIA guys, they want to take off any kind of identifier that could mark them and be kept on their record so nobody could recognize them. I'd get several of those a year.
Well, Ken, how difficult is it to remove a tattoo?
Well, it's not cheap, it's not painless, and it's not fast.
Ugh.
Okay.
Sounds like now, I don't want this.
Wonderful.
I don't want to do this.
Where do we sign up?
Well, here's the good news is he's focused at the end result. And the individual treatment itself is so fast that most people don't believe it. What happens is the laser goes through the skin. It's non-invasive. It doesn't do anything to your body, but when it finds the pigment of the ink, your little snap, and you feel like somebody popped you with a rubber band. Now, body will send blood. Like if somebody punched you in your arm, your body will send blood up to the region where your nerve cells are, and that's why you feel it. And that little sting is like mostly reported to me as like a sunburn. And for the most part, it goes away after about 20 minutes. You forget about it till 6 weeks later when you come in for another treatment, because this is not a one-time treatment. There's a lot of factors involved: the age of the tattoo, the color of the tattoo, the placement on the body. But the most significant factor is the person's immune system. The immune system is grabbing onto that ink and absorbing it and passing it out of the body. That's how it disappears. So it's a natural bodily process that starts as soon as you get hit with the laser in 6 millionths of a second. But even a laser treatment of today, you don't see any effects for 3 or 4 weeks.
So what if it's a really big tattoo and it covers a lot of your body?
I do everything from a ring finger, which will take 3 or 4 seconds, that is over, to full back tattoos. Now, if the tattoo is large, I do not want the client to be sitting more than 20 minutes at one time. So I'll divide a back, let's say, into 4 or even halves, and then give a treatment on that quadrant or half. And I don't have to wait 6 weeks to do another part. I can do the other part, let's say, 3 weeks later. So 3 weeks, we do the top. 3 weeks later, we do the bottom, and just keep repeating it. Normally, the sessions are separated by at least 6 weeks, and that gives a chance for your body cells to absorb, and not so much your body to heal, but the process takes time. It's not magic. It's a process that you have to have faith in science and technology, and your body will do the rest of the work.
So, Ken, how much does this all cost, like if you have a medium-sized tattoo, say?
Well, it's a lot more expensive than the tattoo, and it goes by square inch. So picture this. If you had a tattoo on your arm that was 4 square inches, that's typically $150 a session. And let's say you need 8 to 10 sessions. Now, that tattoo probably costs you $100 and will cost you close to $1,000 to get it off.
Wow. So you better think twice, right?
So, Ken, what kind of training did you have to be able to remove tattoos?
I went to Rocky Mountain Laser College, which teaches all different kinds of lasers and all different kinds of treatments. And I think it's the oldest and most prestigious facility in the United States. So I went there, and I'm a certified laser specialist that allows me to operate the laser under the supervision of a medical director. So I have a medical director in case any problems arise, but in 3.5 years, never any problem. There's nothing bad that could happen to this. This just blows up ink in your body. There are some after effects. Scarring is very unusual. Blistering, more common with red ink because people are allergic, but that goes away and the skin heals perfectly. So there's very, very little that can be complicated.
Well, finally, Ken, we know you've removed a lot of tattoos in your day. Can you tell us about one of the more unusual ones that you've removed?
Maybe not on the radio. But everybody comes in and says, I'm going to show you something that you haven't seen before. And most of the time, I have seen it. But recently, somebody came in, and I had never seen this before. Young guy, losing his hair, went to some sort of hair clinic, and they tattooed his head with a million little dots. And he had short cropped hair, and I think it's certainly better than the spray that you used to see on television where they spray your head. This seemed to look okay, but he was very, very dissatisfied. So we gave it a pass of the laser, and I think it worked out well. So after I had never seen that before, all of a sudden, 2 more people came in with the exact same thing. And basically what they did is it looked like the dome of their skull was lighter than the sides, and it almost looked like they had a racing stripe going from side to side. So in those cases, all I did was just laser the 1 or 2 inches where it was inconsistent. Because you can't see the effects of the laser for a couple of weeks, they haven't been back, so I don't know. But given the initial reaction of the skin, I think it was pretty successful.
Ken Saylor, owner of Advanced Laser Tattoo Removal in Washington, D.C., thanks so much for sharing your tools of the trade with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much.
Over a half century ago, in a rural Maryland farming community, the Sisters of St. Benedict recognized the need for a school to educate and train children and young adults with developmental disabilities. These women were pioneers. Few options and legal protections existed at the time. Now, the Benedictine School in Ridgely, Maryland is a nationally recognized center for learning, training, and employment.
The school's story is really about the power of one woman, Sister Jeanette Murray, her sheer willpower, determination, and all-around chutzpah. She took charge of this mission with minimal money in her pocket. She forged ahead and never looked back. Joining us to share Sister Jeanette Murray's story and how she empowered others to carry on this important mission are Kelly Malone and Jeff Moran from the Benedictine School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Kelly, how did Sister Murray initially get involved in the school?
There's a story to that. Sister was a principal in Newark, New Jersey, serving inner city children, but was a sister of St. Benedict. And there was a tradition of coming back to school for the holidays. And Sister Augustine Kern, who was the founder of the Benedictine School in 1959, told Sister before she came down that she was very sad because she didn't have enough volunteer teachers to really fully run the school and really needed help over Christmas. So Sister Jeanette agreed to help out over the Christmas holiday. And after helping out, she returned to Newark, New Jersey to her inner city children and thought, I'm really glad to be back with my inner city kids because I don't think working with children with Down syndrome or developmental disabilities is really my calling. Well, Sister Kern must have seen something in Sister Jeanette because that summer, Sister Jeanette was informed that she would be coming back to Benedictine School as a volunteer teacher and, in fact, was going to be enrolled in courses to get her degree in a Master's of Education. So Sister was not happy with this and expressed her displeasure, but the prioress at that time had a wonderful idea to let Sister Jeanette know that they needed help. There was another sister who needed to go away for a couple of weeks and they needed a substitute. And would Sister Jeanette just come down and substitute teach? And while she was at it, would she go through a discernment process and pray to God for guidance, and that the sisters would also have a formal mass, a prayer, to help Sister better discern what her calling in life was. So Sister Jeanette agreed to do this for 2 weeks. And when she speaks about what happened after the 2 weeks, it's magical. She said after those 2 weeks, suddenly that cloud of anxiety and fear was lifted, and suddenly I knew that this was my calling. And she began as a teacher with the Benedictine School for Exceptional Children in 1960. She taught. She was also an administrative assistant. She did a number of roles, which I think all the sisters wore a number of hats. She worked in the dorms as a dorm mother. And then in 1977, was asked and took the reins as the education director for the school.
So, Jeff, when the school first began, there were just 19 students, right?
Yes.
And they were children with what types of disabilities are we talking about?
Primarily when the school first began, it was more children with Down syndrome. And the population has changed dramatically now. We have more children with autism. As you know, 1 in 68 children being born now are diagnosed with autism. And now we have many children who are functionally nonverbal. The students that we're getting are more challenging for our teachers and for our clinicians, but through Sister Jeanette's patience with children and inspiring the staff that we have now, everybody really embraces these children and works very closely with them to make them as independent as possible. Our mission statement is Benedictine is helping children and adults with developmental disabilities reach their greatest potential, and we're reminded of that every day.
As the program developed, and it, you know, here Sister is now at the helm, I guess she really saw a need for other types of services, which is how you all keep developing. So what do you offer now to these children and adults?
With the children, obviously, we are a school for students 5 to 21. And then at one point, Sister realized when these children would be graduating at 21, where would they go? So Sister went out and raised money for group homes for the adults. So we have a very strong residential program. And Sister also said, well, they just can't live in homes. They have to be productive. Sister always believed in the dignity of work, and we established a number of vocational training areas on campus, which would then teach both students and adults job readiness skills, work ethic. Everybody at Benedictine who works gets a paycheck. It's the dignity of work, which is one of the principles of the Benedictine order. So we have, be it a car wash, a graphics area, a cleaning service, a recycling area, all of our individuals and students will find out what they like to do and what they're good at. And all these training areas, then they will work in the training areas, which will then lead to community employment. We are all about, through Sister's vision, to have our folks out in the community as much as possible, to be independent as possible and included in the community.
Joining us today is Kelly Malone and Jeff Moran. We're talking about the life and legacy of Sister Jeanette Murray and the school and training facility she built for children and adults with disabilities. Jeff, can you just give us a few examples of what kind of work these students do?
Absolutely. We had a young man who's named Steve, and we have a laundry on campus. So he trained in the laundry, learned his work skills, learned his social skills, people skills, and then he got a job housekeeping at a local Marriott hotel. We had Neil, who underwent travel training with public transportation to help him become independent. And he also got a job, an internship at a local hotel as well.
Wow. So they're not just given jobs. They're given support all the way.
They're given opportunities and support.
Right. Fabulous. Well, Kelly, let me ask you this about Sister Jeanette. We read that one of her students entered when he was just 4.5 years old. I can't even imagine. It seems so young. Can you share that story with us?
Well, sure. The student had no family and was in the social service system, essentially. Was having a lot of behavioral difficulties, acting out a lot. And I think at some point, the folks who were trying to take care of him said, we just can't do this. And Dale came to Benedictine around the age of 4 in 1969, so in the early days, and essentially was raised by Sister Jeanette. Dale took an immediate liking to Sister Jeanette, followed her around. The sisters would joke that Dale was her shadow, and Dale talks to this day of having wonderfully warm memories of cuddling up with Sister on the couch to watch television after school. The sisters were able to help Dale and all the other children learn how to cope with behaviors and their stresses in order to take advantage of learning opportunities. The beautiful thing about what the sisters established is a recognition that all people have something to contribute and all people have great potential. And of course, despite the fact that this little boy had so many issues, they knew that all he needed was love and that he would thrive with love and thrive with people who could see his potential. And they did a beautiful job raising him, and he still works at the school.
Well, we also know Sister had quite a reputation for being very tenacious and never took no for an answer. She even had some very impressive board members. One, for example, General Colin Powell. How did he get involved? Can you quickly tell us that?
Well, Kelly and I, in our role of community outreach, we bring our faculty and staff expertise out into the community to parent support groups, do some training for first responders so they understand our population of students and individuals. And any time that you go out and you're doing this, if you ask the audience if they know anybody with a developmental disability, more than, I'd say, a third of people do know somebody with developmental disability. Hence, that General Powell knew somebody with developmental disability, and the mission of Benedictine resonated with him, and he was asked to be on the board. And he joined and was a very great board member, contributed a lot, both of his time as well as his funds and his expertise. Many of the board members, many of the people Benedictine are touched by the same mission.
And I bet incredible contacts. I can't imagine his little book of...
Absolutely.
So is Sister Murray still living?
No, Sister passed away in March of 2013, ironically on the feast of St. Benedict.
She must have planned it that way.
Well, yes.
In fact,
you're going to go out, you go out in style.
The day of her funeral, we had a horrendous snowstorm, and everybody looked at the heavens and thought, you know, Sister wanted us to, the key people who knew her and loved her were there for the funeral. It wasn't packed with lots of people who maybe didn't know her very well, but just wanted to be there just because everybody else was going to be there. So it was very special, and we knew that Sister was planning her own funeral's weather as well.
Oh. And how old was she when she passed away?
She was 88.
Oh. And we cannot let you guys go and very quickly tell us that she had a meeting with one Donald Trump. And can you just quickly tell us about that?
As Mark Twain said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So this may be urban legend, but this is what I've been told. Sister was introduced to Donald Trump, went up to a meeting in New York, talked about what Benedictine is all about. Donald Trump wrote a check out, pushed it across the desk. Sister picked up the check, looked at it, somewhat rolled her eyes, put it back down on the desk, pushed it back to Donald Trump, and said, "I expected more zeros." I think Donald Trump was a little taken aback and said, "Oh, okay," and reached in and took out another check and wrote one with more zeros.
Really?
Isn't that cool?
I hope she was wearing her habit, too.
Well, she had a tendency to fondle her cross when she was going out asking people for money.
That'll work.
Yes.
That'll work.
May I close with just a short quote from Sister?
Sure.
Sister said before she died that she was a better Benedictine sister today than she would have been had she not had the opportunity to serve the population of children and adults with developmental disabilities. I think that's such a powerful statement given how she felt when she initially came to the school.
Kelly Malone and Jeff Moran with the Benedictine School located in Ridgely, Maryland. Thank you so much for sharing the story of Sister Jeanette Murray, a wonderful example of the power of one woman.
Boomers looking for a little midlife reflection are spurring on a growing travel trend, spiritual retreats, kind of a what's it all about Elfie vacation. You unplug, de-stress, recharge, and reconnect, often with yourself. Our go-to travel guru, Deb Stone, joins us on the phone from Santa Fe to shoot the breeze about the booming popularity of, quote, introspective vacations. Welcome, Deb.
Oh, hey, babes, just say ah now.
We want to actually go somewhere, though.
Yeah.
So, Deb, why do people go on spiritual retreats? I mean, what are they looking for?
Well, you know, there's a million reasons, but, you know, some people are in transition, whether it's between relationships, between jobs. People who need inspiration, they want to make a change, they want to gain a new perspective, they want maybe a deeper sense of themselves, or they could need healing. Maybe somebody close to them has passed away or they've been ill, or just simply they just need a breather from the day-to-day routine, the day-to-day hassles, and they just need to chill.
So what types of spiritual retreats are you really talking about? Religious, non-denominational? Do I have to go by myself?
You can go by yourself if you want.
I don't want to be by myself.
You can go with your significant other. You can go with women only type of retreat, a group, organized or not organized. You know, anywhere can be a spiritual retreat, whether it's a cabin in the mountains, a tent in the woods, a temple, a church, a monastery. But typically, spiritual retreats are surrounded by natural beauty so that you can cut away all of life's distraction and just focus on yourself.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't be the same if you were like overhanging Highway 70 or something.
Not quite.
No, I'm thinking of a 5-star retreat. I mean, does that cut the bill for a spiritual retreat?
I'm thinking of a masseuse 24/7. What about that?
Actually, you can have your cake and eat it too in terms of spiritual retreats. It can be as, you know, basic as you want it to be, where you just are really just focused totally on yourself, or it can be as comfortable as you want it to be. And typically, the types of things you're going to be doing in a spiritual retreat or when you're there can range from anything from meditation and yoga to a focused breathing to journaling about your thoughts to just walking and hiking or movement of some kind, even arts and crafts, creative types of spiritual retreats in that respect, or body work where you would like somebody to do a massage for you, or even things like drumming and or dietary sessions where you want to learn about what you want to put into your body. There is just a range of options available.
I hope we don't have to eat tofu and all the green stuff on this retreat. Do they have chocolate on this retreat?
And they cut us off of wine or whatever.
You're going to be like a monk.
Want our mojitos. So, Deb, where can we go? I mean, we want to go someplace fun. So give us a good example.
Good examples. First of all, there's a couple of companies that do some great organizing of spiritual retreats. There's the Journeys of the Spirit, the Retreat Company, the Art of Living Meditation Institute. But for example, I don't know if you're interested. Are you interested in a silent stay retreat?
No.
We wouldn't last 1 second
in
that
radio,
place.
Deb.
What about this one? Journeys of the Spirit has this fabulous retreat to Peru where you can awaken your creative spirit through art, ceremony, and meditation by visiting Machu Picchu and the Sacred Valley of the Incas, and visits to spiritual sites, temples, yoga, meditation, hiking, participation in ancient ceremonies with healers.
Ooh. Oh, that sounds
good. Well, you know what? It's very high altitude there. I've been there. Is there someplace a little lower on the ground you can recommend? I had trouble breathing, frankly.
Well, there's the Feathered Pipe Ranch in the Montana Rockies.
Ooh.
Offers a lot of different retreats. They have a wonderful women's retreat that is called Soul Fire, where you ignite your inner divinity. And then there's also this fabulous one to Panama, where you you really go out on these boats to connect in a very respectful and responsible way with the whales and the wild dolphins.
Oh, so we can swim with the dolphins.
Well, they say that there is a possibility, but that you will get wisdom from the connection that you make with these creatures.
Ooh. I can get a lot of wisdom from a good massage. Just send me to a massage camp.
Or from watching the fish swim in the water, maybe. So, Deb, how much do these cost? Give us a range.
You know, if you're going to do that bare bones silent retreat, for example, you can do it per night and have it for about $100, $120. And that's bare basic, meaning you're going to bring your own food, you're going to cook your own food. But then you can go all the way on up to, for example, that one in Peru, which is about $3,500 exclusive of air for 10 days, for example. So it's a big range depending on how comfortable you want it and how far away, how far flung the destination is.
Well, Deb, they'd have to pay me to go on that silent retreat. That's all I have to say.
I don't think you'd last very long.
I don't think so. Deb Stone, the Babe's go-to travel guru, as always, it's been a blast. Let's all three go on a spiritual retreat.
Oh,
but I think we really should skip that silent one.
Hear, hear.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.